from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, in our opening hour this morning, President Obama will address the American people tomorrow about the crisis in Syria as he tries to convince Congress to support his plans for military intervention. And we'll discuss the latest developments in Syria and Washington, D.C. And meanwhile, Russia has called on Syria to give up control of its chemical weapons to international control. That's all coming up after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. President Obama gears up to address the American people tomorrow and continues, along with Secretary of State John Kerry and Democratic leader and former Speaker Nancy Pelosi, to make his case to the people and to Congress for military action against Syria in the wake of charges that the Assad regime used poison gas in the ongoing Syrian civil war. We want to discuss the ongoing crisis in this opening Forum hour and update you on what's going on. And let me tell you who is joining us for the hour. Here in studio, David Mark is with us. He's editor-in-chief of Politics, an online community focusing on national politics. He's also former senior editor with Politico. Welcome, David Mark.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Stephen Zunis with us once again in studio. He's professor of politics and chair of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco and is senior analyst for Foreign Policy and Focus. Welcome, Stephen Zunis.
Nice to join you.
Good to have you. Also good to have Steve Weber back with us by phone, professor of political science at UC Berkeley, whose books include The End of Arrogance, America and the Global Competition for Ideas. Steve Weber, welcome to Forum.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. I want to begin with David Mark and get sort of the political landscape in focus here. And it's clearly going to be an uphill fight. In fact, President Obama could lose the battle, as Prime Minister Cameron did in Britain. How do you assess things at this point, though, just in terms of, well, number crunching?
In terms of raw vote totals, it is not looking good for President Obama and the administration. At this point, there's an estimated 22 House members and about 22 Senate members, interestingly enough, who are actually affirmatively on record in support of some use of military force. That is about 10% of what you would need, maybe a little bit less than that. But the math doesn't really add up. There's all kinds of scenarios I'm getting from sources on Capitol Hill, one that the Senate might be allowed to vote because there do seem to be the numbers of persuadable members there, and then just not even hold a vote in the House. There's not much precedent for something like this. President Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry say that ultimately they do not need congressional approval, so this is all uncharted territory.
Well, it's particularly uncharted if this resolution doesn't go through and the president decides to exercise. And he said, you know, I can act on my own, in effect, hasn't he?
Well, that's right. And there's plenty of precedent for that. Had he done that in the first place, he would have had a lot of arguments on his side. Now, by putting it in the hands of 535 members of Congress, he's created this new level of complication. And, of course, you have all kind of shifting alliances, and some would even call it hypocrisy on both sides. A lot of Republicans, particularly in the House, who were willing to give then-President George W. Bush almost unilateral power in Iraq, and some Democrats on the other side who are usually opposed to some sort of U.S. military force, but in this case, they're willing to give a president of their own party the green light.
Well, there's war weariness throughout this country. I mean, the polls seem to suggest that Americans don't necessarily want to get involved in another military action. However, the president has the leadership behind him. I mean, he has Nancy Pelosi and he has, to the surprise of many, John Boehner, as well as Eric Cantor.
He does. That's an excellent point, that he does have the leadership. But on both sides, they're not exactly what's called whipping the vote. They're not trying to dangle goodies in front of their own members, a road, a bridge, some other inducement that they would usually do for a legislative vote. It seems like Leader Pelosi on the Democratic side is being more forceful about this. She's written, I believe, five letters now to her own House Democratic caucus trying to urge a yes vote. It seems like on the Republican side, House Speaker Boehner and Majority Leader Cantor are kind of saying to their own members, yeah, we're for it, but we're not really going to push you. It's a vote of conscience. And they wouldn't say it openly, but they might kind of want to see President Obama get strung up on this one.
Well, how do you account for their essentially being behind him, though? I mean, in many respects, they have been dedicated to certainly undermining this president, making him look as bad as possible.
Well, part of it would be just the hypocrisy angle that they voted for other, you might say, foreign engagements in recent years, Iraq, military appropriations for all kinds of other military actions. They also have military bases in their own district, certainly in the Cincinnati area, in the Richmond, Virginia area with Eric Cantor and his district. So there's all kinds of hometown inducements. But again, just having the leadership before something does not mean that their own members, the rank and file, is going to go for it. We've seen that on budget vote after budget vote, all kinds of other domestic matters as well.
We're talking to David Mark, who is editor-in-chief of Politics. And I'm just wondering, though, about the risk here if Congress doesn't back the president. I mean, the risk really is of a constitutional crisis, potentially. But also, in addition to that, let's just be pragmatic for a moment. The president has not necessarily been the greatest salesman when it comes to issues of any kind, really. I mean, when he went over to Copenhagen, for example, when he went to G20, I mean, there's been kind of a record of not necessarily being able to put the pressure on or do what he wants to do.
Right. The art of moral suasion doesn't seem to be President Obama's strong point. It's interesting, but because candidate Barack Obama was quite good at that. Obviously, he won two presidential elections.
Candidate Barack Obama talked a lot about not getting engaged in war also.
Well, that's right. That's right. For whatever reason, though, he has not really been able to make the case. It seems like Secretary of State John Kerry has been much more forceful on this, and he really seems to have the passion behind him. I think President Obama is kind of played a type in some sense. He's a realpolitik leader. He wants to get U.S. troops involved or U.S. military force involved only on a limited basis, only as a last resort. And he's never seemed very enthusiastic about getting involved in any way. He seems like he was kind of dragged into it.
Well, Steve Weber, he did say, I set a red line, although later on he said, I didn't set a red line. The world set the red line. And what seems to be on his mind, particularly in the forefront of his consciousness in all this, as well as many Americans who back him, is U.S. credibility. I mean, we keep hearing that phrase about U.S. credibility, particularly with respect to Iran and North Korea. And I should mention for listeners that there may be something to change the equation here. Russia has come out and said they would lead an international control over the weapons that Syria has, over the chemical weapons that Syria has, so they couldn't be used henceforth. Does that change things in your mind?
No, Michael, I have to tell you, I'm quite skeptical of what the Russians have done. Actually, the reports have just come out, and you should take a look at them to see the details. Secretary Kerry made a claim about, you know, if Assad wanted to avoid an attack, he could turn over all of his chemical weapons to international control. It was kind of a non-starter, and even the State Department spokesperson later came out and said it was a rhetorical play. In a way, I think the Russians have seized on this as an opportunity to buy time, because they feel, and I think appropriately so, and particularly given what David just said, that the momentum here is moving against the president. And so, you know, every day, every tick of the clock actually works against Obama on this one. I think the issue of credibility is already blown, quite frankly, and we should probably talk about that more because it is really important. But I think the issue now is, can we restore and regain any credibility, not is there something to save here?
Well, I was reading Andrew Sullivan, who usually is very thoughtful about questions of the nature that we're discussing here, particularly on the subject of credibility. He said it's there's credibility in staying out of a civil war, mainly, and knowing that we can't enforce certain things. It's better to lose face by choice than by walking backward to defeat. But you have a different slant on this, I think, don't you?
Yeah, I do. I think that, you know, credibility is in the eyes of the beholder, and the president is the person who created this problem for himself. Remember, he did make the argument about the red line. But even more importantly, last Saturday, when he announced what he was going to do about this, it was a stunning speech. If you listen to it again, he stood up and said, it is in the vital or critical, I believe is the word he used, national security interests of the United States to act on this propagation, and he said that he felt he should be using military force. Now, you don't get to be president and say it's in the critical interests of the national security of the United States, and then turn the decision over to someone else to make. That is where the problem lies. And so he created the problem. You know, the world did not create this problem for him. If we had wanted to stay out, we could have stayed out. If we had wanted to go in, we could have gone in. But what Obama has done has been to strike a note of ambivalence, and that is, in my view, the worst thing he could have possibly done in this situation.
Ambivalence or irresolution and, frankly, indecisiveness?
Well, I think all those things are in place, but, you know, you can hardly ask other people to stick your neck out for you if you won't stick your neck out for yourself. And I think the kind of reception he got at the G20, it was entirely predictable. I think he's going to get exactly the same reception in the U.S. Congress. I think we're seeing that as time rolls on. And I think the really interesting, I mean, it's going to be a very, very interesting decision for the White House. If the Congress does turn him down, is he going to act? I think Secretary Kerry is going to try to push him to do something. But again, if you look at Kerry's statements today, he actually used the phrase incredibly small in referring to, you know, his view of what the military strike would be. In a remarkable way, this whole debate has gotten away from what Assad has done. It's gotten away from the Syrian civil war, and it's become this argument about these internecine battles inside Washington, D.C. This is not the argument we want to be having right now.
Yeah, in fact, some of the more strident conservative commentators have talked about the fact that the president has let so much time elapse, that they keep talking about things like incredibly small and not major military intervention at all. But when it comes down to the crunch, you're in favor of doing something?
Yeah, well, I think that we're now, you know, in a different world where I could roll the clock back 2 years, I might have a different view. But I think at this point we've put so much on the line and so visibly for the international community, and presumably we'll talk a little bit about how the Israelis are looking at this and what it means for their view of what happens next in Iran, that to not act in some respect now actually becomes a huge victory for Assad. It becomes a huge victory for the Russians and the Chinese on this issue, and it's going to really hamper Obama's efforts going forward. I think there'll be hell to pay. You know, Rahm Emanuel, former chief of staff, said, a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. And unfortunately, I fear we've not only wasted this crisis, we've actually turned it upside down to make it a crisis in the United States rather than in the region.
What do you say, though, to the argument from Samantha Power that they have that Assad has a huge stockpile of chemical weapons, we haven't put a dent in them, and we're not going to put a dent in keeping him from using them unless we do something?
Well, I kind of think that, I mean, it's interesting. Of course, Samantha Power has been an activist on human rights issues and humanitarian intervention for a long time. She's what people call a liberal hawk. And I'm sure she was arguing for intervention in the Civil War before the chemical weapons event. And arguably, you know, given what has been going on in the region, there was a case to be made for some kind of action even before this chemical weapons thing happened. In some sense, Assad handed Obama a gift. He gave him an opportunity to define his strategy for what the war would be or what the war would not be. And Obama, in my view, just flubbed it. You know, you don't get that many opportunities to define your strategy that clearly. He turned it over to the U.S. Congress. Big mistake.
Steve Weber, again, is professor of political science, UC Berkeley, and Stephen Zunis is professor of politics and chair of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco. And Stephen Zunis has an article, actually, in the Huffington Post called Six Reasons Not to Go into Syria or do any military intervention to Syria, and you say this is essentially illegal under international law, that strategically it makes no sense, and of course argue that there are unintended consequences, just as kind of right off the top, as well as other reasons. The United States has backed itself into a corner here, though, and it can't use the UN because UN, Russia has a veto, and China will go along with Russia on that veto. And what else can it do now in terms of just saving face?
There are very few good options, unfortunately. In fact, there have been very few good options in Syria ever since the armed struggle surpassed the initial broad-based, democratic, nonviolent pro-democracy movement that emerged in March of 2011. The credibility issue works both ways. Obviously, I think Obama regrets having made the red line comment that it does kind of back him to a corner, and then you have all this kind of this big push around his supposed manhood and all that kind of thing of living up to these standards. But there's
well,
also
being a commander in chief.
Yeah, right. But you know, constitutionally, he really had no choice but to go to Congress, and he really has no choice to abide by what they say. But on the credibility issue, you know, we do have the problem that, as with a lot of issues, he's dealing with the legacy of his predecessor. The false claims about chemical weapons in Iraq, the disaster that the Iraq War proved to be. Even John Kerry, who's been pushing this so hard as Secretary of State, insisted that Iraq had these vast stockpiles of chemical weapons, even greater than before the Gulf War. Biden, as senator, said very similar things. Even Nancy Pelosi, who said who's now saying that there is. Is currently saying that there's no doubt that there are that the Syrian government was behind the attack was on Meet the Press in November 2002 saying there's no question that Iraq had chemical weapons. Now, personally, I believe that the Syrian regime really was responsible for the August 21st attack. But when you have that kind of record, you know, there's a lot of skepticism both here and abroad. And again, the violation, it's very hard for us to make the case. We have to enforce this flagrant violation of international law in this chemical weapons attack by engaging in another flagrant violation of international law that is the unauthorized use of force. And while I think the Russian and Chinese vetoes of what were very mild resolutions on Syria previously, and they're blocking any decisive non-military action is totally unjustified.
They even blocked resolutions to condemn Syria.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's terribly wrong, but let's remember that since China joined the UN in the early 1970s, China's used their veto power 8 times, the Russians, formerly Soviets, during that same period 18 times, and the United States during that same period 83 times. Unfortunately, even in a place where one might make the case for liberal internationalism and making a decisive stance, unfortunately, the U.S. record on a whole number of these issues puts us in a poor position to take leadership.
And that goes right to the heart of that whole question of what is being continually mentioned as credibility in your mind.
Exactly.
Yeah. Steve Weber, what do you say to that?
Well, I think it's a very good point. And the issues around international law are really important for the long term. But in the short term, again, seizing control of this particular debate, I think it's really too bad that what we're arguing about are sort of arcane points of international law rather than focusing on what it is that Assad did here and what the interests are of the United States and our allies in the region over the long term. This is not just about Syria, obviously. It's about Hezbollah. It's about Hamas. It's about Iran. It's about what we did and did not do in Egypt. And it's about, fundamentally, at the end of the day, I think, the unfulfilled promise of Obama's 2009 Cairo speech. You know, he went to Cairo, you remember, in 2009 and proclaimed that it was time to redefine America's relationship with the Middle East. And I feel that, you know, this is where that speech is going into the graveyard. And it's not going to get solved in the multi-party talks of the Palestinian-Israeli situation. It's not going to get solved here. We're going to, at the end of this administration, be exactly where we were at the beginning of the administration, is in a total mess in the region. And it could be worse rather than better as a result.
Well, what is the message, Stephen Zunis, to Hezbollah, to Iran, who we have threatened and said we would act preemptorily against if they continue their nuclear buildup, or for that matter, North Korea, which somehow is overshadowed by Iran to a great extent, if the president does not act after he's backed himself into this corner?
I think what we've seen is when the United States has acted unilaterally, militarily, it has led to a dramatic growth in support for extremist movements. We saw how Hezbollah's standing increased with the U.S.-backed Israeli war in 2006. Unfortunately, they're losing their standing by their support of Assad, which has alienated a lot of their.
Did you say
supporters.
Unfortunately?
Yes, I said fortunately. Hezbollah is losing their standing thanks to the fact that most people in the world, Sunni and Shia alike, do not like the Assad regime and what it's doing.
Well, it's a sectarian divide, though, isn't it? Between Hezbollah is Shia, and
And this is one of the tragedies of going to the armed struggle, that what was a broad-based movement has now turned into a sectarian conflict, has come into a proxy war. But to get back to my main point, that it seems that whenever the United States has intervened militarily, it has led to some kind of blowback. It has strengthened the narrative of extremists who say, oh, the United States just wants to kill Arabs. The U.S. is hypocritical by supporting some dictatorships while opposing others, you know, by supporting the Israeli occupation and getting self-righteous about U.N. resolutions and international legal norms that involves other countries. And of course, you know, when a country bombs another country, people tend to rally around the flag. And I think this is one piece a lot of people are missing about Syria itself, is that this rally around the flag phenomenon is true, I think, anywhere, but especially in a country where the Assad regime has been so, and his father as well, have been so effective at manipulating the strong nationalist sentiments that the people of Syria have. This would fill right into the narrative, oh, we're the last bastion of secular Arab nationalism against both Islamist extremism and Western imperialism.
They also argue that they have religious tolerance. The same argument that Mubarak made, and now Coptic Christians in Egypt are suffering under this.
And the divide and rule policies have gotten the majority of the minority groups on his side. And the difference between Syria from the Assad regime, from Gaddafi and from Ben Ali and Mubarak, for that matter, is that it has a social base. When you combine the minorities and the vast Ba'ath Party apparatus and the military and the crony capitalist class, you get them all together, we're talking about at least a third of the population still supporting the regime, despite all of its horror. Whereas I would say Gaddafi, for example, is probably in the single digits of popular support in his final days. So the political dynamic, my concern is for whatever material damage the United States might do to the strategic assets of the regime will more than make up in terms of political gain, especially since, for me, the best hope would be to try to sow divisions within the elites of the Ba'ath Party and the military with Assad and some of the hardliners. Remember, this is not one-man rule like those other cases. This is more of an oligarchy. But, you know, when you bomb a country, the elites are going to close ranks, and the hopes of getting divisions that could lead to an internal coup or pressure for negotiations would evaporate.
Let me bring our listeners into this and, by the way, give you an opportunity to express your own sentiments. We should mention at this point, opposition to U.S. airstrikes against Syria is surging. A USA Today Pew Research Center poll finds that more than 2-1 Americans, 63% to 28% of those surveyed on Wednesday through Sunday, say they are against U.S. military action. If you'd like to join us, you can do it toll-free right now at 866-733-6786, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Again, our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have immediately onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or, of course, you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And I would be remiss if I didn't ask you, David Mark, just about, Israel and Saudi Arabia, two strong American allies. They're very much opposed to the Assad regime at this point, it's safe to say. They would like this resolution to go forward. They'd like some kind of military action on the United States. They hold a great deal of suasion with American congressional representatives because there's a lot of money there and oil and so forth. AIPAC as well as the Saudi lobby. How much does that play into what's going to happen in Congress or play out?
I think it's an important component here. I did think it was interesting that Secretary of State John Kerry was the one to say that Saudi Arabia is now on the side of the U.S. in terms of supporting some kind of military strikes in Syria. We didn't hear that from the Saudi foreign ministers. They kind of like to keep a lower profile on that. It's maybe not great for their domestic base. They have their own Shia minority out in the east that can cause them problems. But overall, they didn't exactly object to that statement from Secretary of State Kerry. The Israeli angle is also quite notable in that the Israelis tried to stay judiciously nonpartisan out of this for some time. Now it seems like they are very much coming along on the side of some sort of military action in Syria. Certainly, the supporters on Capitol Hill, AIPAC, and others in Washington, D.C.
Well, they see this tied to Iran. And it is tied to Iran.
Right. And Israel has crossed that red line, you might say, four or five times in Syria. They have been willing to take military strikes behind the scenes.
We'll continue. We'll hear from you when we return. We have David Mark with us, editor-in-chief of Politics, Steve Weber on the line, professor of political science at UC Berkeley. His books include The End of Arrogance, America and the Global Competition of Ideas. Stephen Zunis, also with us in studio, is professor of politics and chairs Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco. He's also senior analyst for Foreign Policy and Focus. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. President Obama will address the American people tomorrow about the crisis in Syria as he tries to convince Congress to support his plans for military intervention. And we're discussing the latest developments in Syria and in Washington, D.C. with David Mark, the editor-in-chief of Politics, which is an online community focusing on national politics. He's former senior editor with Politico. He's here in studio. So is Stephen Zunis, who is professor of politics and chairs Middle Eastern Studies at University of San Francisco. And he's also senior analyst for Foreign Policy in Focus. With us by phone, Steve Weber, professor of political science at UC Berkeley, whose books include The End of Arrogance, America and the Global Competition of Ideas. Let me read some comments coming in from you, our listeners, and you can make comments directly on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and click on this segment. Beth writes, and let's not forget, we have been told for years now that we have cut programs and services to Americans because the federal government lacks money, yet we now have money to spend on a new war, and it will be a new war. Colin writes, very disquieting to hear that the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, a lobby for the Israeli government, is now pressuring congressional representatives to vote for an attack upon Syria without any authorization from the United Nations. Edgar writes, suppose Congress allowed the strikes, but then the president, quote, takes his time in ordering a launch. Wouldn't that keep Assad off balance? He'd want to keep his major chess pieces separated to minimize damage. This could persist indefinitely, reducing his ability to prosecute his war while we might launch few or maybe no missiles. And a couple more website comments. Another listener writes, the Obama regime has consistently stated that Assad has no legitimacy and Assad must go from the outset of the Syrian civil war. Therefore, it would be foolish to imagine that the Obama regime will not attempt to exploit this attack to weaken the Assad regime to the fullest extent possible and may well use the opportunity to arm the various rebel forces. And this could result in the collapse of the Assad regime and hence the collapse of any organized Syrian government and the compromise of whatever WMDs Assad has. Here's another email. Eugene writes, President Obama's created a lose-lose situation. If he strikes, he's a war president. If he does nothing, he's weak. We want to bring Robert Dineen into this discussion. We'll go to your calls in a moment as well. But Robert Dineen, senior fellow for Middle Eastern and Africa Studies with the Council on Foreign Relations. And good to have you back with us, Robert Dineen.
Great. Great to be with you. Great to be with my fellow Californians, even though I'm in Washington, D.C.
Well, I read your piece in The Washington Post, and essentially your position is let's send Assad a message he'll understand, meaning maybe not even perhaps talk about limited military action or anything along those lines.
Well, what I was trying to say was the following. The president has laid out an agenda in which the objective of using force is to send a message to Assad about the use of chemical weapons. And from my perspective, that's a very limited message, and it neglects everything else that's happening in Syria. I mean, the unintended message that Assad will take away from that is it's fine to go continue to slaughter hundreds of thousands of Syrians as long as I don't use chemical weapons. It's important that Syria not use chemical weapons, but that shouldn't be the end of the story, and that shouldn't be the end of the discussion. And so that's what I was trying to point to in that piece.
Well, you also pointed that piece to your own experience with Assad, where he doesn't quite necessarily get message even when evidence is presented to him.
That's right. I had the opportunity on several occasions to meet Bashar al-Assad, to negotiate with him over Syrian behavior that the U.S. government, which I was serving in at the time, I was serving at the National Security Council of the White House at the time, and this was at a time in which we were very concerned about Syria's support for terrorism, the fact that jihadis were flying through Damascus Airport, crossing the border into Iraq, and killing American soldiers and civilians in Iraq. And so we went to Assad and said, look, you need to stop this. We can have a good and constructive relationship with you, or we can have a much more difficult relationship with you. And we wanted him to make the choice. And he misread our engagement as a negotiation. And by doing so, he didn't change any of his behavior, and he just wanted to string us along because the longer that we were talking, it meant that there was nothing bad that was going to happen to him. And that was his primary concern. And so I was trying to say to drawing from that experience that we need to be clear that the message we deliver to him is the one that he will take away. And the way that the resolution is structured, the proposal that the president has put forward to Congress is structured in a way that Assad will take away all the self-imposed limitations and not be deterred by it. And that's not to say we should be pushing for a ground invasion. It's not to be saying we should be pushing for a massive war. It just means we need to have a strategy. We have to have clear objectives and then figure out how the use of force fits into that larger objective. The debate today has been all about an instrument, the use of force. And I'm trying to say, wait a second, let's try to figure out what it is we're trying to achieve and then talk about the tools and instruments to achieve that.
Well, there's been a good deal of criticism of even the use of force not necessarily having any clear end game, and there would be unintended consequences with any kind of military intervention, which prompts me just to ask you, if we send a message to him to stop slaughtering his people and that message is strong, it could escalate, obviously. And then we face, talk about lose-lose situations, about 40% of Syria is now under control of rebel forces, and those rebel forces, some are arguing, have been taken over by jihadists and al-Qaeda and al-Nursa. They're even beheading some of those who they see apparently as being too secular. I mean, this could be a choice between Assad or what we saw with the Taliban in Afghanistan, or maybe even worse than that.
Well, I think that's right. I think the way that the situation is structured is, and the choices before us are between bad and worse. Again, what has struck me throughout this last few weeks is that for the president, the issue is chemical weapons. The issue is not Syria. He seems to want to be to ensure that that international norms surrounding the use of chemical weapons usage are upheld. That's important. That's critical. But what he's also trying to do is to say inadvertently, look, the situation in Syria is so complicated, we don't want to tilt the balance because if we go if we strike too hard, then we may actually help topple the regime that, by the way, he had called for being toppled, and even worse elements will come into play. On the other hand, if the strikes are too weak, then they'll be seen as a slap and have no effect. This then has set off an intense debate here in Washington. The ultra hawks are saying, no, what you're proposing is too weak, we need more. And increasingly, we see the president has been willing to negotiate. He got John McCain on board for the type of strike he's going to do. But in doing that, he's then going to lose, those who are very uneasy about the use of force, perhaps within the Democratic Party, from supporting himself. So the domestic political element of getting this resolution also very much affects the strategy and tactics the president is pursuing.
Yeah, we should mention that Senator McCain said publicly on a Phoenix radio station just last week that if there were boots on the ground, it would mean, in his mind, an impeachment should move forward against President Obama. Let me bring your callers in here and bring our callers in here, I should say. John, you're first up. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. Excellent discussion, gentlemen. Thank you very much. Just wanted to kind of move us in a bit of a different direction and ask the question, from the vantage point, what is the legal precedence and, I guess, constitutional authority that we vest in the executive to give them this unilateral ability to make war? As I read the Constitution, particularly Articles 1 and 3, I was pretty certain that the war powers were divided into first.
We're having some problem with receiving your call here, John. It's breaking up, but I think I get the gist of what you're asking. And Steve Weber, I had mentioned before the potential of a constitutional crisis, but President Obama is the commander-in-chief. Let's talk about precedent.
Yeah, I think the debate over whether or not the War Powers Act applies and how much time the president can act before he has to go to Congress for authorization, this is again, from my perspective, an important debate. It's an important set of issues. It does not rise to the level of importance of dealing with this issue. There's no question that through both law and precedent, if there is, quote, a critical national security interest at stake, the president has the right to take action and seek congressional approval later. No one is asking for a declaration of war, which only, of course, the Congress is able to make. What we're asking for here is an authorization that the president says he doesn't even need legally. So the interpretation is important. It's fuzzy. Other presidents have done things without that kind of authority. Sometimes they've sought that kind of authority. To my mind, that debate will happen afterwards in terms of what it means for future presidents. Obama has put it in the front of action. And, that's a lawyer's action, not a leader's action, unfortunately.
And you say what, Stephen Zunis?
We're a nation of laws, not of men. the Constitution is quite clear that as commander-in-chief, the president can use forces in the event of an attack against the United States. For example, back in the late 1700s, obviously, if our country was under attack, you couldn't wait till everybody got in their horse and buggies and made their way to Washington if Congress was on recess at the time. But in offensive wars, ones that are not responses to immediate attack, it's very, very clear that only the Congress has the right to authorize it. In addition to Articles 1 and 3 that the caller mentioned, I should also mention Article 6, which says that international treaties that are signed and ratified are to be treated as supreme law, and that includes the UN Charter, which precludes the use of military force. So even if Congress does authorize force, it would still be illegal.
Let me bring another caller in. We go to John as our next caller. John, welcome.
I'm an ex-Marine, and this kind of operation happened on my watch. It would have happened quickly and with extreme secrecy. Assad has had all this time to move this gas around. How does he expect his generals to do this operation with any efficiency when they won't be able to find this stuff?
I think it's a fair point. And Robert Dineen, you want to talk about just the lag here in terms of the time that has perhaps caught the president? I don't know that they're going to go after those chemical weapons sites anyway, because it would wreak such havoc. But Assad certainly had time to maneuver and manipulate things.
Well, I think there are two elements here. I mean, there's the operational element, and then there's the political one. From the operational point of view, the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, Martin Dempsey, has said that waiting a period of time will not affect the operational effectiveness. I think you're right. The likely strikes or the strikes likely intended targets are not the storage or the weapons themselves, but the means to deliver them. And I think they have a target set that they feel confident in that are fixed targets and not ones that could be easily moved around. There's a second consideration, though, and that has to do with the political viability of taking action after you've gone through this political process. Arguably, the president, upon receiving confirmation from U.S. intelligence sources, could have gone for a much more limited, the kind of very limited strike that we've seen the Israelis now employ on four occasions for limited strikes on Damascus. If the point of the strike is to send a message, again, what is our objective here? What the president has said has been largely to deter and degrade. But I think the emphasis really is on the deterrence side. And once you're getting into the game of deterrence, then we're talking about perceptions.
Excuse me, I think that was General Dempsey, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who used those words deter and degrade, but he was talking specifically about deterring and degrading the use of chemical weapons.
No, that's in the text that the White House sent to Congress for the first draft that went through the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
I'll defer to you here. I heard it from General Dempsey. Yeah.
They're using the same language. Yeah, no one has monopoly on this text. It may have been used as well by Dempsey, but it's being drawn from the actual text of the resolution that the White House first sent to the committee and that the committee now has passed.
Well, here's a thought. I want to go back to you, if I could, David Mark, from a listener named Max, who says perhaps President Obama doesn't really want to strike and wants to look tough, but pass the responsibility to the Republican House.
Yeah, there's been a lot of theorizing about this, that it's all part of some Machiavellian plot to go through a lot of rigmarole on Capitol Hill, put Republican lawmakers particularly on the spot, and at the end of the day, do nothing, which is what it seems like the administration – its initial instinct was in the first place. I think that might be reading a bit too much into it at this point for all the reasons discussed. I happen to think no matter what happens on Capitol Hill, there will be some military action going forward. But I think clearly drawing in Congress and putting them on the hook, frankly, was part of this whole strategy. And President Obama was actually quite open about it when he made that announcement in the Rose Garden about 9 days ago.
And we go to more of your calls. Brad, join us. You're on.
Thank you for having me, and it's actually timely. It appears to me that all of this is turning into a political dialogue, and we're missing the point of the issue that's involved here. I don't even believe the main issue is use of chemical weapons, although I can understand why someone would use that as a focal point. And that is that how are we conducting the advancement of ourselves and other countries, other nations, civilization around the world? United Nations should be constructed, and I believe was constructed, to stop incidents where either internally or from across the border, one nation attempts to resolve their political issues through massive destruction of their citizenry and their population. And this should be the primary issue. If we address it that way, then we can attempt to resolve it that way. And is it to our benefit? I would think it would be, because when you allow any type of political institution to determine the future of that institution through such violent means, then it's going to leak over and affect the neighboring countries, and it'll be a domino effect that will circle the world. So how do we want to continue existing and coexisting with our neighbors? That should be the primary issue. And if we just boil it down to that and strip away the politics, then we may be able to decide what action we want to take.
Well, I appreciate your framing it that way. And, Brad, thank you for the call. At this point, though, Stephen Zunis, let me go to you. And I'm getting emails that say, well, let's go to the U.N. International Criminal Court, for example. And the arguments against that tend to be, you know, the process is too long, et cetera, et cetera. Questions about how effectual, really, the criminal court is. And other people are calling in and writing in and saying, how come nobody else is on board on this? I mean, there's backing, there's support, but nobody's willing to be the police officer except the United States of America.
And unfortunately, given the unevenness of our positions on some of these issues, including chemical weapons, it'd be more like we're being a vigilante instead of a policeman. As some of us have been writing about for years, but a CIA document came out very recently. The United States actually facilitated Saddam Hussein's use of chemical weapons against Iranian forces using U.S. satellite footage to target
against
concentrations.
Yeah.
And the fact the United States blocked a Syrian initiative back in 2003 at the United Nations when they had a non-permanent seat to create a weapons of mass destruction free zone for the entire Middle East. We didn't want to do that because it would mean Israel would have to give up its chemical and biological and nuclear stockpile, and Egypt, another U.S. ally, with its chemical weapons. I mean, there are a number of things. Mistakes, I believe, our country has made over the years around the universal application of certain of these things, which puts us in a very poor position of taking leadership now.
This whole situation is littered with mistakes, I mean, on every side. And at this point, I don't know, you know, Steve Weber, when you look at it from any standpoint, it does seem to be what we kept hearing during the Iraq conflict. The United States particularly is between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah, I think we've put ourselves in this situation vis-a-vis the UN Security Council. Now, I want to be clear about this. In my view, it would absolutely be preferable to get UN Security Council imprimatur for an action here. But the reason we can't get it, the reason it's not even plausible at this point, is because of what we did in Libya in 2011. We got Security Council backing for that, precisely by telling the Russians and the Chinese that the operation was going to be limited and that it was not going to involve any effort at regime change or trying to get rid of Gaddafi. The Russians and the Chinese went along with it on those terms. They felt that they had been misled. And as a result, there's no way they're going to vote for a Security Council. The veto has less, in my view, to do with Syria and has a lot more to do with the United States and the loss of trust.
Well, you know, the irony in all that to me is the fact that Libya is often touted as the good war and the war that was successful and so forth. I don't know what we have in Libya now. Is anybody really able to analyze it? It's just fractionalism. There are a lot of loose weapons around, and Benghazi occurred.
Yeah, it's a mess on the ground, but I think that the longer-term consequence is going to be almost impossible for us to get the Russians and the Chinese on board for any kind of limited military intervention, whether it be about responsibility to protect, whether it be about humanitarian intervention, whether it be about something more significant than that, including perhaps the Iranian nuclear program. This is something we've built for ourselves, and it kind of reflects, I think, what has come up in this conversation, which is this sort of just lack of a strategy focused on objectives around the region as a whole. What do we want to have happen here? Do we want Assad in power? Do we want not want Assad in power? We're sending lots and lots of mixed messages. And in that context, boy, I can't blame anyone for saying, without a really clear idea of why we're doing this, I have to vote no before I can even, like, consider the objectives on the positive side. So I think that, you know, the president really needs to stand up tomorrow night and correct a lot of these errors. He's got to go back. He's got to take a position around the region as a whole. He's got to make a very clear statement about what he wants to see happen in Syria and how he sees that relating to his strategy for the region as a whole. Otherwise, I just don't think he's going to get either the public or the congressional support for this.
Well, Robert Dineen, can he pivot around? Can he say, well, I said there was a red line, but now there isn't a red line, or something to that effect, or I said that Assad should go, but now I've changed my mind? I mean, what really kind of options does he have to change or pivot here?
Look, I think Steve Weber is 100% right. He put it much better than I could. And to a certain extent, the perceptions that now exist in the American public are in part those of the president's own creation. We've had 2 years of a bloody war in which the president first started out by saying Assad had to go because it looked like it was inevitable. And then it got entrenched, and basically we've been unwilling to get involved because it just has been too hard. And this is a president whose agenda is to get the United States out of the Middle East, not to go into another Middle East war. That's great. The American public supports that. Everyone supports that. However, the situation now has gotten so bad in Syria that inaction has had all sorts of knock-on effects. You have a country like Jordan that is straining under the burden of refugees, Lebanon, where there's now violence taking place as a result, and also straining under refugees, Turkey. All of Syria's neighbors now are feeling the strain of the conflict that's happening in Syria, and there's the danger that as this situation escalates, that there could be a breakout by Assad that leads to a regional war. So the stakes are quite high. The only hope that I see right now, and it's very interesting, I agree with, by the way, with his analysis of the Russian behavior and the Russian and Chinese behavior at the UN. That said, I think the Russians right now, as well as the Iranians, are a little bit embarrassed by Assad. They're standing with him. They are his ally, but they're not happy about the fact that he used chemical weapons. They put him, he put them, rather, in a very difficult position, because up until now, basically, the war was going on. He could say al-Nusra and other al-Qaeda-related people are on are with the rebels. So basically, you know, it's an ugly war, but it's just yet another war.
Well, of course, the Russians have said, we don't know that those chemical weapons weren't used by the opposition. I just want to remind listeners that you are listening to Forum, and we're talking to Robert Dineen as well as Stephen Zunis and Steve Weber and David Mark. And I want to also announce that Charlie Rose has recorded an interview in Damascus with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, which will run in its entirety in a special presentation tonight at 9 o'clock p.m. on KQED Channel 9. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to KQED.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to another caller. Well, you wanted to finish, Robert. I want to get...
I did. Just one more point about the Russians, though, and that there has been news today that is a potential game changer. The Syrian foreign minister went to Moscow today. He met with the Russians. Secretary Kerry made an announcement that said basically that a conflict could be avoided if the Syrians were willing to give their chemical weapons to the international community. And the Russians welcomed that statement. They said, this sounds good. Let's check with the Syrians. The UN has now, Ban Ki-moon has come out and said, this is good. So we may be, and it's premature, but there may be something here that is emerging. And I think that points to what I was trying to say earlier, which is the Russians don't like the fact that they're defending the Syrians here. They're doing it, but I don't think it comes as a pleasurable act for them.
Let me bring Damien on next. Damien, thanks for waiting. Join us, please.
Thank you very much. And a great conversation. First, I had to disagree with some of the commentators. Russia and Iran are very strong behind Assad because there's key regional issues for this. But there's also an inherent bias against Assad. And I'm sorry. My point is this. Why would we support Assad? I mean, why would we not support Assad if he is fighting al-Qaeda and Nusrat? Because of Obama's policies in the Middle East in the last 4 years, ever since he's come in, has basically to create an al-Qaeda, Iraq, and affiliated groups. His non-action in Iraq, in particular, has been devastating because what's happened is you've created a very strong battalion, organized groups, military groups that are al-Qaeda affiliated. And it seems to me that a strike on Syria does nothing more than enhance their capability, strengthen their resolve, and weaken those moderates and secularists who form the backbone of Assad's army and his population against these people. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you. All right. We thank you for the call. Robert De Niro, I'm going to go to you on this again because one hears that argument frequently from time, or I should say from time to time, that you know, we're just by going against Assad, we're really going against ourselves. We're giving much more help to those who are even in greater opposition against us.
Well, first of all, you know, in the Middle East, there's an adage, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. That's not the case. Oftentimes, the enemy of my enemy is also my enemy. And I would argue that in the case of Syria, you know, what started with as a popular uprising turned into a bloody civil war when Assad started to mow down peaceful demonstrations. Now, this comes against a backdrop in which the United States has long had a conflict, a peaceful conflict with Syria over Syria's behavior, over its support for Hamas, Hezbollah, for jihadists killing Americans in Iraq, for its involvement in the assassination of Prime Minister Hariri in Lebanon, for a whole host of reprehensible behaviors by the Syrian regime. So this is not our guy. This is not our friend. We've tried to deal with him. I negotiated with him on several occasions, trying to bring him along. He stuck his finger in our eyes. So, you know, we've tried the nice way. So I don't see this guy as someone who's our friend. The fact is, yes, he's opposed to al-Qaeda, but that doesn't make him our ally.
Well, we got seconds left. Steven Zunis, final word from you.
Sure. I mean, if I believe that a military strike would deter future chemical weapons attacks, would ease the suffering of the Syrian people, would lead to the would accelerate the downfall of the regime, replacing it by a stable democratic government, I would support it, even though it was illegal. But what we've seen historically, and this is, and empirical evidence supports this, that when foreign governments intervene in a civil war where there is incredible human rights abuses by the regime, it ends up prolonging the conflict and increasing the killing because the regime feels, oh, we have nothing to lose now. It's the gloves are off, and the rebels
say— including Bosnia in that?
I'm including Serbia. Bosnia, I think, is more of an exception,
so,
but certainly Serbia.
So
the ethnic cleansing didn't really start until the NATO bombing began. And Kosovo, this is average. These are average.
Let me get a final word from you, Steve Weber.
I'm just sorry we didn't get a chance to talk about how this is all being viewed from Tehran and from Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. I think the bigger issue on the other side of this, there probably will be some small, I think, frankly, cosmetic military strike against some of Syria's capabilities. But I think the thing we're going to be talking about 6 months from now is looking back at this issue and wondering, why did we make this mistake and put the Israelis in the position that we will that they will then find themselves 6 months from now?
Well, we will continue, obviously, to watch and monitor. Let me thank David Mark, Steve Weber, Stephen Zunis, and Robert Dineen, and thank you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated in the evening, 10 to 11. We got another hour up ahead of Forum. We're going to talk about the gender gap of women in technology and women in computer science. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.